Welcome to Coaching Culture, the podcast where we discuss how we can use sports and not let them use us. I'm JP Nurbin, the founder of Thrive On Challenge, and the mission for this podcast is to connect leaders in athletics to help us create a transformational culture by building leadership and character. Now let's get started. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, episode number 52, The Competitive Cauldron, How to Make Your Players More Competitive with our guest, Brian McCormick. In today's episode, Nate and I are going to talk with Brian about the advantages of tracking winners and losers in practice. Now, Nate, I know you've had some experience with this in your practices, and we'll touch on that after the interview, but what were some of your biggest takeaways from our conversation with Brian?
Well, you know, two things that really stuck out to me listening to Brian talk about his use of the competitive cauldron. I thought the first one was that it really gives you an objective data point. I was just reading a book recently here called Chasing Perfection by Andy Glockner, and it's a book about analytics in the NBA, but he's got an interesting story about Larry Eustace at Colorado State talking about one of their players that they were really reluctant to play because they didn't like the way that he looked on defense. In other words, he wasn't in a great stance, his hands weren't exactly where they wanted, he didn't go over screens the way that he was taught to in their practice, he was a transfer. But when they started digging into the analytics, they found that when he guarded guys, they didn't score. And then the book goes on to sort of talk about how that conversation changed the way the coaches felt about that player and his playing time from that point forward. And, you know, in listening to Brian today, we don't all have SportVU data or Synergy, you know, especially if you're a high school coach or a youth coach at your disposal where you can really dig into some of the more complex analytics that are out there in various games today. But one of the easy ways to be able to get an objective viewpoint of your player's productivity is simply to look at what percentage of the time are they winning games in practice. And I thought that was a great point, and Brian's going to illustrate that a little bit, talking about some players that maybe he had seen a little bit differently after he started looking at how many times they were winning and losing in their practices. And I thought the second thing, you know, one of the reasons that we've experimented with a competitive cauldron in some of our practice structure is simply because players are more engaged. You know, when we think about what players are looking for when they go out for sports, they want to play, right? And creating a situation that's competitive where we're keeping score and where that score matters day in and day out, game after game, drill after drill, I think players just enjoy competing for the sake of competition. They enjoy playing when there's a score up on the board and they know their coach is paying attention to that. And certainly as we've talked about and continue to talk about building culture, there is no substitute for player engagement. And I think the competitive cauldron really can lead players to having a more satisfying, fulfilling experience in your practices. In this episode, Brian's going to talk about what exactly is the competitive cauldron and how it can be valuable, not only in structuring your practices, but encouraging your players to become more competitive in the context of those practices. And at the end, we're going to talk a little bit about how you can implement a competitive cauldron into your context. Whether you're a basketball coach or coach of another sport, regardless of what level, Brian's got experience in many different sports at many different levels, and he's going to share with us some tips about implementing the competitive cauldron to benefit your program. Let's get started.
All right, I'm with Brian McCormick, who's the head coach of Broward College. He's also the author of several books, and specifically in the relation towards basketball, and I'll let him describe and tell us a little bit more about those books as well. Brian, thank you for coming on the Coaching Culture Podcast today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Brian, fill in a little bit here, just kind of your background in coaching, refereeing as well, as we were just talking about before we started this podcast, and a little bit about your books.
I've been coaching for a long time. I've coached virtually every level. Starting out, you know, I mean, I really started out coaching with Special Olympics, and then I moved on to, you know, CYO, you know, Catholic school leagues, little kids, you know, fifth to eighth graders, and eventually worked up through AAU high school, and then started with colleges, and then coached overseas, and then came back and did high schools, and then went back overseas, and then came back and did high schools, and then ended up now back at the junior college level. I think I've written 20 books now. I guess probably the ones most people know of are Crossover, The New Model for Youth Basketball Development, and maybe The 21st Century Basketball Practice. and maybe developing basketball intelligence. I think those are probably my three bestsellers. And then, yeah, I do a bit of refereeing. When I was living in New Mexico, and there's not a lot to do in New Mexico, so I started out with youth games and high school games, and eventually I managed to get up, and now I do college games. So,
what I think is cool about your background is that, you know, you're not just in basketball, you've been in soccer, but I think your commentary when it comes to your books, your website, the blogs you write, you know, you talk about things that transcend the game, you know, to go beyond basketball, but they go into other sports as well. You know, just two things I think really connect us. And one is that we both coached in Ireland. I kind of came in after you had coached there. The other piece is when I had initially gotten to coaching, I came across the book Crossover. I think actually I came across it on like an Alan Stein recommendation, but I read Crossover and nothing, I don't think anything has changed. No book for sure has changed my coaching more than the book Crossover. It really, beyond taking a games-based approach to coaching, it was more about like challenge, being willing to challenge everything I thought about coaching, everything I knew about coaching. Like, you know, just I had to re-examine everything. And so I think that Crossover was the start of it. And, you know, it wasn't until years later that I really started to rethink my leadership style and culture and how you build culture. But Crossover was definitely the seed that caused me to reflect on my experiences about why I did things and why did I do them the way that I did them. And so I really appreciate you writing that book for sure. I know that you've had some other great books as well. Well, today we're just going to get into the competitive cauldron. I definitely feel like there's future episodes that we'll be featuring you on. But the competitive cauldron is something that I kind of came across for myself just naturally through the way of coaching and just trying to make things more competitive. Definitely appreciated your perspective and take on it in 21st century. And then, you know, after I'd read that, I actually came across it in Training Soccer Champions by Anson Dorrance. Just tell us a little bit about what is the competitive cauldron, just kind of the basics on it.
You know, first, I got the idea from Anson Dorrance's book as well, originally. And I've used it now with a girls' high school team, a boys' high school team, and now at the college level. My version of the competitive cauldron is simply I keep track of wins and losses of every drill, you know, and being a kind of games-based type coach, most everything we do at practice is competitive anyway. And so when there's an opposition, we keep track of wins and losses, and then we keep track on a daily basis, a weekly basis, and then, you know, for the entire season. Like I said, virtually everything we do in practice has a competitive element, with the exception of, you know, our warm-ups at the very beginning, but almost everything else has some kind of competition. And so anytime there's competition, there's a winner and a loser. When I first did the competitive cauldron, I just kept track of winners, but realized that over time that it would be better if I kept track of winners and losers. And kept, you know, and based it on winning percentage and not just total wins.
And why did you come to the conclusion that you needed to track the losers as well?
It helps to incorporate then, you know, if people miss practice or if they miss one drill, or I just started doing that when I got to the college level. And so, you know, at the high school level, I didn't really have an assistant coach. So every drill that we did had, you know, if we had 12 players on the team, every drill had 12 players involved. Whereas now, you know, I'll do, you know, guard post breakdown or something like that. And so, you know, the guards may be doing a drill and only have a chance to get one win, but the post might be doing something else and they could get three or four wins. And so to balance it out in terms of the scoring, keeping track of wins and losses versus just a total of wins helps to keep that a little bit more equitable, you know, for multiple reasons. Like I said, the differences in practice, if somebody comes late to a practice because of class or something like that, and they miss out on a chance for a win, or all those kind of reasons to keep it a little bit more balanced and the scoring a little bit more equitable. That was the main reason for keeping track of the wins and the losses.
Did you have incentives at various levels, and how have those evolved over time?
Sure. So when I first started, I didn't want it to be seen as punishment. So I actually, before I started it, I started having, you know, kind of end practice conditioning, you know, so we'd finish and then we'd end with, you know, liner or suicide or whatever you want to call it. And so then once I put the competitive cauldron in, whoever won on that day, they got to skip the conditioning. So it became a reward at the end of practice to not have to do the conditioning. And at the high school level, both times, boys and girls, that's what I've done is, you know, we just end with a small conditioning and whoever wins that day gets out of the conditioning. At the college level, I haven't done that. We don't have a daily punishment or reward. I also, at the high school level, I used the competitive cauldron. I used it to determine my starting lineup. Game by game basis, whoever were the top five going into that game, those were my five starters. Whether I started three point guards or three centers, whoever the top five on the list, those five started. And, you know, I should mention these were the boys team, I think, was a freshman team, and the girls team was a JV team. So I didn't do that at the varsity level.
What is your incentive at the college level now with it?
I'm fairly fortunate that I have pretty smart and pretty internally motivated players, and so I don't publicize it, but they kind of figure out that when I write out teams on a daily basis, I kind of write them in order. So whoever's, you know, if I'm writing out a team, you know, from left to right, or two teams, you know, and I'm going every other person, you know, it's whoever's first, whoever's second, whoever's third, whoever's fourth, and so they kind of figure out who's in the lead. But I don't use it. I use it to inform our rotations, but I don't determine rotations by it. It doesn't affect my starting lineup too much. Although it did, it does have an effect on playing time, I would say. And it helps me notice things. So like at the beginning of the year last year, a girl who I didn't think was very good and who I expected to be an end-of-the-bench player was actually in the lead in the cauldron for like the first 2 weeks of the season. And so it caused me to actually pay more attention to her and see, like, you know, what's she doing that, you know, that I'm not seeing that's being reflected in her team winning a lot of games. And as it turned out, one of the things that I learned is that in a short time frame, there can be a lot of noise in terms of, you know, being a small sample, you know. So if at the beginning of the season, when we were teaching more, we didn't have as many competitive drills and so forth, you know, it's easy for somebody to kind of in 1 week be kind of outside of where you would expect them to be, because it's a relatively small sample. And it turned out over the course of the season, I was right. That girl wasn't the top player like she was for the first week or two. And by the end of the year, she was more towards the bottom where I would have expected her to be. You know, it's a small sample and it may not be the best, you know, evaluative tool, but it can also show different things. So like there came a point last year where my assistant coach came to me and said, "Hey, I don't think this girl's who's been starting all season, I don't think she's been playing well the last couple of weeks. I think you should start this other girl instead of her." And so I went and looked at, you know, kind of stats from the last three games. And to me, it didn't confirm what my assistant said. And then I went and looked at the competitive cauldron for the last 2 weeks, because she said that she wasn't practicing as hard. And she actually had been, was first in wins over the last 2 weeks. And so I went back to my assistant. I was like, "You know, I know that's your impression, but objectively, she's led our team in rebounding, you know, the last three games, each game. And in terms of practice, she's first in wins over the last 2 weeks and first in wins over the last 3 weeks. And she's, you know, in the top five for the season." So to me, I don't see anything that suggests that she's complacent or not practicing hard or, you know, has this kind of downward spiral that you see. I use that to, in our discussions among the staff, to kind of justify why we kept starting her instead of making a change to a different player.
Anson Dorrance, in his book Training Soccer Champions, he actually explains that he publicly posted the rankings. It's not something he talks about, but it's something that he posts there, and that he felt like he didn't even need to speak about it. Have you ever
posted your rankings publicly as far as the cauldron, and what are your thoughts on that?
When I was coaching boys high school, they pretty much would ask after every practice, and I would like, I'd have it on my index card that I wrote out practice plan basically every day, right? So I would have my plan, and then on the back of it, I would have the players basically ranked in order. Like I said, with my team right now, I actually asked them at one point last year if they wanted me to publicize it. They said no. They didn't think it would be a good idea. And so I went with their judgment because I trust this group pretty much, you know, and I go with what they say on most things. So what I do is, and I got this from John Sparrow, the U.S. men's national team volleyball coach, UCLA volleyball coach. I used to, when I lived in Irvine, he was the UC Irvine men's coach, and so I used to go to some of his practices. And so he would write out practice on a blackboard in the gym so that everybody saw exactly what was going to happen during practice, where they needed to be, et cetera, et cetera. And so I do the same thing. So when the girls walk into practice, there's a blackboard that's sitting against the bleachers, and it has every drill for that day, and it has the teams for every drill. And so when I write out the teams on a blackboard, you know, I write out, you know, in a straight line. So, you know, it's player one, player two, player three, player four. So whoever's player one, you know, to the far left is probably the top player, and whoever's player four or five or whatever is probably the lower ranked player, if you can visualize that.
And one thing that I think coaches might be interested in is considering what it is that you're tracking in terms of wins and losses, because I'm assuming, and I've read most of your stuff, that we're not just talking about five-on-five or whole-team competitions, right? We're also including smaller-sided games and that type of structure in your practice. So, you know, you'd mentioned that you use a lot of that kind of a game-based approach. You want to speak a little bit to just the different types of competitions that you might use in a practice that you're scoring?
Sure. I mean, we use, I mean, all of it, one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, four-on-four, five-on-five, transition games, half-court games. We do, I mean, like right now, we do a passing game. And, you know, I talked about it in one of my newsletters last year, you know, that I got from Basketball Immersion, just basic two-on-one passing drill, and we just get points if you get a steal, because to me, if you're on offense, two-on-one in a fast break, you should score every single time. So if you get a stop, you get a point. And then, you know, we play for 4 or 5 minutes, and whoever has the most points, they win that drill. So, you know, one of the things that I had to teach my girls when they'd come in my office, you know, and they'd ask, you know, we'd have individual meetings, and they'd ask where they're ranking and stuff like that, and they'd worry about their winning percentage. But in reality, last year, my number one player had right at 50% winning percentage, because there's, in almost every drill that we do, there's more losers than there are winners. You know, because we could play one-on-one with all the guards. I have 8 guards, so 1 guard wins and 7 lose. You know, if we play 3-on-3 with all 12 players, 3 players win, 9 players lose. Sometimes I'll keep track of when we play things like ball handling tag or other types of, you know, keep away type passing drills that I use. We'll keep track of wins and losses in those. Just about any time there's an opposition, I'm tracking it. And pretty much everything that we do has an opposition except for the occasional shooting drill. And I generally don't keep track of wins and losses for shooting drills, just because I do, once we get into the season, there's 1 or 2 drills that I do keep track of. For shooting as a competition. But for right now, we don't track wins and losses in shooting drills, because I have enough players who need to make changes to their shot that I want them concentrating on what they need to do to get better, as opposed to winning a shooting drill. And so I think that is the one weakness of my system, or the way that I do it, is when everything is competitive, there is the tendency to do what you can already do and not try new things, especially if your, you know, starting position is based on whether or not, you know, you're winning games in practice.
So if you were going to give a commercial to coaches out there about why they should experiment with a competitive cauldron, you know, either in a portion of their practice or you know, implemented in a, for a basketball coach coming up this season, you know, what would be the value in it that you would really recommend, you know, for coaches to pursue it?
I think there's two things. One is a lot of coaches complain that players aren't competitive enough in practice. And I think when, you know, you're actually keeping track, especially over a period of time, you know, it builds that competitiveness because, you know, people think, well, you know, I make them run a sprint at the end, but I think players get so accustomed to running sprints, you know, whether it's while they're shooting free throws or for missing a free throw or for losing a game, whatever, you know, running one sprint for a basketball player is not that much of a punishment, you know, like it's not that hard to run up and down the court one time, you know? And so I don't think it really motivates a player one way or another to, you know, try to play harder just to avoid a sprint, or to concentrate more on a free throw just to avoid a sprint. So I think that's the first thing is if you feel like your players don't compete at practice, this is one way to get them to compete more. And then two, you know, I believe firmly in confirmation bias. And I believe that coaches have confirmation bias. And once they form an opinion of a player, you know, what they see confirms to what they already believe. And so, you know, typically that means that your starters, you know, get more opportunities, get more chances, and your bench players get fewer opportunities and fewer chances. And because of that, the discrepancy between your starters and your bench players grows rather than staying the same or getting them closer together. And so I think that this, while far from perfect, allows some form of objective measure to see if what you see subjectively fits some form of objective measure. So to me, those are the two biggest reasons is wanting hopefully increase the competitiveness of practice, and then two, to give you some form of objective information that you can use, you know, whether it's to determine playing time or to influence playing time or just to give you support when you do determine the ultimate playing time. I mean, I used it last year for that. When one girl came to me and complained that she wasn't playing very much, I just said, look, you're last on the team in wins in practice over the season, over the last week, over the last month. You've been in, you're in the bottom two every single time. Like, why should I play? You know, and then, you know, had her tell me, you know, if you're not, if your teammates are beating you every day in practice, why should you get more playing time than them?
You mentioned the player experience there a little bit. And so I kind of want to touch on that, which is obviously what we want them to be more competitive. And obviously it helps you to make better decisions potentially and really even just look into some stuff. But when it comes to player experience, you know, most of us, we don't just want our players to be competitive. We want them to enjoy themselves and we want them to feel good about themselves. And so do you feel like it's helped in more cases than not players to enjoy the practice session?
I would definitely think in more cases than not it helped or encouraged the players. I would say the first year I used it with the girls' junior varsity team. So one thing to add along with it is when I used it to determine playing time, I also said that I was going to play every player in every game. So the two kind of went together. And so I can't definitively say that everything good was because of the competitive cauldron, because it may have just been that everybody was playing, if that makes sense. But I think between the two of them at the girls' JV level, I think that was a really successful season in terms of they got along great. They, you know, we had really no kind of typical behavioral type issues, and a lot of this has to do with where I was coaching and who I was coaching. You know, and I think the fact that everybody knew they were going to play made our practices better because they knew that they were going to get real minutes and not just, you know, hopefully I'm going to get a token minute if we can blow out this team. And so it kept all the players engaged throughout every practice. And so every drill was competitive because every player was improving. Because what I see, again, a lot with teams is you've got your five or six or seven players who play the most, and then you've got your five players who don't play very much. And so the gap at the beginning of the year is fairly small between, say, player five and six and seven and player eight, nine, and 10. But because one group's getting playing time and the other group's not getting playing time, they're getting more reps in practice, et cetera, the discrepancy grows. And then practices get less competitive because your best players now become more dominant against your worst players. It didn't come a lot along with some of what I think potential negatives there are. There wasn't, you know, fighting amongst players or arguing. I mean, it even came down to the last one or two games we were playing to win the league championship, and one of the girls who had earned and was going to get her first chance to start, she actually asked if she could not start, and she wanted the girl who was probably our best player, she wanted her to start because she said, well, it's an important game and we should have this girl starting. I was like, no. I was like, you earned it. You're starting. And she ended up having a great game.
I think you touched on a big thing, which I actually, on an earlier episode, had Trevor Reagan on, and we were talking about the Cauldron a little bit. We didn't go really too much into it, but we just talked about these tools that we use to kind of build culture, to build competition, to build up that growth mindset and debt. You know, from my take on it is that we really need to be intentional about explaining the why behind it. And I come back to competition and to the root of the word, you know, from the Latin, to strive together, you know, and that explain to players that, you know, this competition, whether you're even using punishment at the end of it or not, of like conditioning, you know, or you're just using it as a system of rankings to reflect on, it's all about just making this a more enjoyable experience where we're all striving together to be our best, you know, that you're going to make me a better player. Iron sharpens iron, you know, and that's kind of the mentality. And I think that's a big piece of it.
And that kind of leads us into, you know, the last part of this interview a little bit here, and that's talking about how to implement it. You know, if there are coaches that are interested in the benefits of the competitive cauldron, what kind of steps would you recommend that they take, you know, in terms of how to collect data, determining what they want to, what they want to measure, what the appropriate scope would be? What would be some tips that you'd have for coaches looking to maybe experiment a little bit with a competitive cauldron?
You know, I've done it two different ways. So when I was a high school coach and didn't have quite as much time to plan practice and didn't have an office at the school and so forth, I had my practice on an index card and I would pick teams in the moment. So, you know, I would say, okay, we're going to play 3-on-3 and we have 12 players. Okay, you three are white, you three are black, you are red, you're blue. And then whoever won, I would just write down the names of the winners on my index card. You know, so I've done it like that. Now, you know, like I said, I pre-plan everything. I plan out all the teams before practice, you know, so I usually at home, I write out my practice plan, come up with my teams, look at, you know, base it on the rank order that I'm using, whether it's for the full season or a week or whatever. And then, you know, when I get to the office, then I write it out on the blackboard so everybody sees it. Everybody knows the teams. I don't have to call out anything. You know, we finish one drill and okay, two teams, 5-on-5, and they go over, they look on what team they're on, they change, get a quick drink, and they're back on the court and they're ready to go. You know, so I think you can do it, you know, the kind of less organized way where you're kind of picking teams and writing it down as you go. Or, you know, I mean, I guess my advice would be start with some simple things. You know, I assume most coaches don't scrimmage quite as much as I do. So I imagine they have a larger portion of practice that's you know, less competitive or non-competitive. So if you only have, let's say, half hour practice that is really competitive, then maybe just use that half hour and say, okay, you know, every day in practice we do 1 3-on-3 competitive game, we do 1 5-on-5 competitive game, so we're just going to keep track of those two things. Or, you know, maybe you play 1-on-1 every day, and so you're going to do 1-on-1 and 5-on-5 or whatever. However you want to do it. But, you know, I probably wouldn't try to do the whole practice to start with. And I'd probably look at it for a while before I decided whether how I wanted to use the data, whether I wanted to tell my team, whether I wanted to, you know, use it to determine starting lineups, determine playing time, inform playing time.
All right, Brian, where can people find and connect you if they have any other questions, you know, find out where to buy all your books and all that stuff?
Okay, probably Twitter is the easiest place to find me. I'm pretty sure it's at Brian McCormick. Website is either 180shooter or learntocoachbasketball.com. I have a newsletter that you can sign up for on the 180shooter.com site in the top left-hand corner, I believe. And all my books, for the most part, are available on amazon.com and or Lulu, L-U-L-U.com. If you search Brian McCormick basketball, you'll probably find him.
Nate, that was a fantastic conversation with Brian. Tell us a little bit about your experience with the Competitive Cauldron.
Well, JP, we've tried using the Cauldron in different ways over the past few years. In fact, last season, we tried to use it kind of as a preseason evaluative tool, where we had set up in the course of our first week of practice about an hour each day where we were going to play some competitive games and keep track of winners and losers. And we sort of had this complex scoring system that we were using. And quite honestly, it didn't work out the way that I expected it to. And after listening to Brian, I think I understand a little bit better where we went wrong. The first thing I think we should have done better is we just had too small a sample size. And Brian talked about this, that in a way you have to let the numbers work over the course of time, that just being able to look at a couple of days' practices or a week of practice doesn't necessarily allow time for variance to smooth its way out over the course of it. Traded with it and went away from it for most of the rest of the year. We probably should have been a little bit more persistent with it. And I thought the other thing that we could have done differently in listening to Brian here is just had a more variety in terms of the kind of games that we were playing. You know, he had mentioned using in his practices 1-on-1 and 2-on-1 and 3-on-3 and 5-on-5 and a lot of different games, a lot of different contexts to kind of get a more well-rounded objective look at his players, and we didn't do that. And I think that was one of the failures that we had when we tried this last season. The best experience we've ever had with it was a couple of years ago when, for whatever reason, I think we had a game that was postponed because of weather, and we ended up with this extra day of practice in the middle of the week. And so we decided to just do a competitive cauldron for that one day. And so we told the kids at the beginning of practice, we're just going to play games today, lots of different kinds of games. We're going to tally the winners. So the winners are going to get a point every time they win a drill. And at the end of the night, the top three scorers, the kids with the most win points, would get to be the first three players in line at team dinner that evening. And that was great. I mean, for us, it was kind of the middle of the year. You know, you're kind of in those dog days of January for us in basketball. And it really did a nice job of disrupting the rhythm. It was something fresh. It was something new. It was something fun. Kids were playing games. And then, you know, we talk a little bit about incentives in the interview. It doesn't always have to be sprinting. It doesn't always have to relate to playing time. Like, just doing something as simple as being first in line at a team dinner or in the showers after the game or something like that can be enough to get kids engaged and excited about the process. So I learned a lot from the interview, and I'm excited that we had Brian on to share with us today.
Yeah, Nate, I think the competitive cauldron just raises a lot of questions about how to implement, but I've used it for many, many years at many different levels. And when I reflect on the experience of it, I know it's never was perfect, but I would always prefer to have had it every year that I did than not have had it, you know, and there's definitely some issues with it. You know, one year I did it where there was, you know, a complete reward system and they were literally scoring points and it was almost like they were earning money that they could buy protein bars and Gatorades with, you know, and it just became so much about the rewards that guys weren't competing just to compete, you know, to be better and for the enjoyment. I've tried to do the Mike Nabors efficiency, you know, and just trying to chart the efficiency and to essentially build my lineup off of that. But I couldn't get the numbers to work, but it definitely gave me some insight into who I should play and who was playing well, you know, and who wasn't playing well. It wasn't strong enough data, in my opinion, to run my lineup off of it like he does, but it was still beneficial. Even just like last year, I was helping out and I was coaching a CYO team at my church. And I had a group of young men, 5th and 6th and 7th graders, and I did a little competitive cauldron. And I tried no incentives. I just said, you know, come to practice, compete, and we'll high-five the winner, essentially. That was about it. Like, great job, you won the game. And you know what? It fell flat, you know, the first half of the year. So I decided, you know what? We'll pick the starting lineup off of it. And instantly, our practices were transformed into a more competitive environment. And so the big thing is, and my big encouragement to coaches out there, is to take it and try it out. Like Brian said, like you said, just try it out one day and then just see how you can tweak it as you go along and ask players for their feedback on it. You know, I think that's a critical piece there. Not everybody has to have this whole huge big system, like you said, where they're running their lineups off of it.
Well, JP, and that's the one thing I would leave coaches with is it isn't about implementing Anson Dorrance's or Brian McCormick's competitive cauldron into your practice. It's finding what's best for you and the best fit for your team. And I think both of us would agree, and Brian would agree, that it's worth experimenting, that there's some value there to increasing the competitiveness for your players and for your practices.
Now, that's it for today's episode. Nate and I would love to hear from you, and you can find our information in the details of this episode. Also, be sure to subscribe to the weekly newsletter at thriveonchallenge.com. If you want today's coaching notes, there's going to be a lot in there. Thanks again for listening in. Have a good one.